The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, and welcome into Game Night. ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're live on our game Facebook page. And those of you that know me and know my allegiances when it comes to my sports teams, you know that I'm very excited about our guest tonight. The Hall of Famer. Former Braves pitcher. There was another team. We don't like to bring that up much, but Tom Glavine is here with us on game night. Tom, how's it going?
Good. Things are good. No complaints. How about you? How's everything going?
We're hanging in there here in Nashville. And the other team, the Mets, we know that, you know, had some good years with the Mets too. But
a little took a little vacation there.
Yeah, a little vacation. And now, of course, a part of the Braves television broadcast with Fox Sports South. So does a great job with them. But, you know, this has obviously been a weird time. We were talking before we came on about how creative you have to be, especially for us that do sports talk radio. We don't have live games to talk about. Things are starting to start back, creep back, but a lot of old games that have been on, and whether it's you guys on Fox Sports showing some of those fantastic games from the 90s with the Braves or MLB Network, you know, I've learned a lot of history, but I'm always curious with athletes, have you always gone back and watched some of those games or your old games, or is this something that you've kind of done during this time?
I haven't done a lot of it. You know, I do it from time to time, obviously, but, you know, I think up until this go around with Fox showing the 95 World Series, the only time I've ever really seen it was on a kind of a grainy, ugly DVD that I had of it. So, you know, it was kind of fun to see it and see it in, you know, much better quality than I have. But, you know, also kind of go through the whole series because obviously having been a part of it and played in it, you remember certain things. Certainly for me, I remember my games that I pitched and stuff like that. But, there were a few things here and there that I had forgotten about. I certainly, you know, it's funny. I was doing a similar Zoom type thing with Fox and Ryan Klesko. And during the course of that Zoom session, Ryan reminded me of the whole bat flip controversy that we had there in Cleveland when Jim Thome flipped his bat and nearly landed in our dugout. And, you know, how David Justice had kind of challenged everybody that, you know, somebody hits a home run, they better do something. And Ryan was always pretty proficient at the bat flip anyway. Didn't need much more coaxing, so to speak. So kind of had forgotten about that and then forgot about Doggy Dustin, Eddie Murray, and knocking him down and some of the trash talking that had gone on during the course of the series. So you forget some of that stuff. So it was fun to relive that and kind of go through that and kind of see how everything – built up and you know how it all you know kind of played out when it was all said and done.
I have a lot of fun on the midday show that I co-host because I'm with a Mets fan and I'm with an Indians fan, and so Darren, the Indians fan, every now and then the 95 World Series comes up and I have to pour a little salt in that wound. But that, you know, I watched that whole series recently on Fox Sports, as you were saying, and enjoyed the intro that you and John Smoltz and Chip Carey, you guys were able to put together. And I was young. I didn't remember it very well. And so it was cool for me as a lifelong fan of not only baseball, but the Braves to relive that. And I know so many people have felt that way. So what's been some of the feedback to go back and like you were just saying, relive those moments that you may have forgotten about?
You know, I think for the most part, like you say, you know, people watch the series and much like me, you know, they forgot some of the details. Obviously, you know, the outcome, but they forget some of the details, but you know, and just in following along on Twitter and stuff like that during the course of the games, it was, you know, it was fun to see people's reactions to big plays. You know, I know obviously Doggy pitched an unbelievable game in game one, just complete domination, like, you know, he had done so many times. You know, and to see him go out there and do that against such a powerful lineup was certainly impressive. And then, you know, my game in game two, it was funny. I remember watching that. You know, I knew it was one of those games where I struggled a little bit in the sense that I didn't have too many easy innings. Seemed like I was kind of in and out of trouble a lot. And then after sitting there and watching that game, like, even I'm watching it and I'm yelling at myself on the TV. I'm like, my God, will you get ahead of somebody? Will you throw strike? But it was just one of those games where I had, you know, again, I had forgotten how much of a struggle it was in that sense, because you see the end result, you know, the numbers were good at the end of the game, but it was a struggle to get there. I remember in that Javi's pickoff of Manny Ramirez at first base and what a huge play that it was. But I had forgotten at what point in the game it had happened. And then when you see fans' reaction on Twitter after that happens and, you know, stuff like that. So, and then it was fun. You know, it was a ton of fun for us because we did the whole Zoom party on game six, you know, and kind of going through that game and then leading up to when DJ was coming up and we knew he was going to hit the home run and having some fun with that. So, you know, when you know what's going to happen, it's a little bit more fun, obviously. And you get to, you know, people get to kind of, I guess, foreshadow what's coming and have some fun with it. So, it was fun. I mean, look, it's a different perspective for me because I went through a similar situation the week before. So I'm a big Bruins fan. And the Bruins showed their 90 or their 2010 or whatever cup year, 2011, when they won the cup.
Yeah.
And you know, for me as a fan, you know, you watch that series and it's funny, some of the things that, again, that you remember and the emotions that you have. And then, you know, even though you know the outcome, you know, I forgot how much I hated that Vancouver team. I forgot that, you know, during game one that Bergeron got bit in the finger. And that whole thing that went on there. So it's just, you know, it was a very, very similar circumstance, like I said, for me watching that World Series, even though I lived it and played in it, to have that experience of going back and kind of, you know, kind of refreshing some memories and at the same time kind of having, you know, a lot of Braves fans, obviously there were at different stages in their lives. Some of them were real young. Some of them were, you know, high school or college people that kind of reliving that and what it all meant to them. It was a ton of fun.
It was crazy too that if you go back and you look at the scores, five of the six games, one run games, and just including game six, yours, Werler's closes it out, but you had the one hit and it was a 1-0 win. That's all it took. But to look at baseball now and, you know, look at it back then, it's pretty crazy to see just how tight it really was.
Yeah, it was. It's a much different game, obviously. I mean, you know, starting pitchers in that series, for the most part, went really deep in the games. You know, the bullpens were kind of what, you know, I was accustomed to, and I think what fans in that era were accustomed to, that, you know, every now and then you saw your middle relievers come in and get out of jams, but for the most part, you're turning the game over to the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning guys. You know, like I said, starting pitchers went pretty deep in those games in that series and a lot of really tight games and for the most part, pretty quick games, which, you know, you go back and you look at some of the time of games on that series and, you know, in today's game, you're not seeing those, you know, 3-hour games or 2.5-hour games, particularly in a postseason, you know, like you did in that series. And, you know, it shows – you know, how different the game is today as opposed to what it was. And, you know, that's just kind of the evolution of the sport, I guess.
Talking with Tom Glavine here on game night, the 95 World Series. The Braves get it done in six games over the Cleveland Indians. So was there ever a point in that run starting from the worst to first team all the way to 95, where, and we know the heartbreak. There was heartbreak before 95 in that, especially that 91 World Series. But did you ever have that feeling of, we have something special here, that we know that it's going to happen eventually. We're going to win the World Series. Was there one particular moment where you really felt that way?
Yeah, when Game 6 was over. I think that when you're going through that, I mean, we knew obviously we had good teams, and we felt good every year that we went into spring training that, you know, hey, we're a team that if barring any unforeseen crazy injuries, we're going to be a team that most likely at the end of the year, we're going to be one of the teams that's going to be in the playoffs, and we're going to have a chance to make a run at a World Series. So I think we felt that every year. Now, how long that was going to last was anybody's guess. And I think that was kind of the big thing that was weighing on all of us going into that 95 World Series was, you know, okay, we've had two shots in the World Series now and got beat. We lost in the NLCS in 93. How many more of these chances are you going to get? Because I think when you're playing, you understand how difficult it is to get to that position, let alone do it every single year or for multiple years at that stage of the game. So you wonder at what point in time your window of opportunity is going to close. I mean, nobody, if anybody in that organization at any point in time tells you that, hey, we knew we were going to run off 14 straight division titles, you don't know that.
Yeah.
But again, when you're in the midst of it, you know, hey, we got a good team. And right now, every year we come to spring training, we're a legit contender to get to the World Series and win. But when you haven't done it, you, like I said, you wonder, when is that window going to close? So I think for us winning it in 95, there was a sense of relief that came along with that. But I think in subsequent years, you know, you take it at a year-by-year basis. You evaluate your team every year going into spring training. And I think for all of those years that me and John and Greg were together, and then, you know, all those years we had Chipper and so many other good players, you felt good each and every year coming into spring training that we were gonna have a really good chance, barring, like I said, some crazy injuries. And we had a couple years where we had crazy injuries. I mean, I think one year we had Galarraga, and he had a cancer relapse, so he was out for a chunk of the year. Javi blew out his knee. I think that was 1999. And somehow we ended up in the World Series, and I think everybody to a man was looking around at it and we're like, how the hell did we get here? But that's just kind of the way it was. But really, aside from that, we never had a year, thank God, where we just had devastating injuries. We had injuries, but always stuff that we could kind of manage and get around.
You brought up Javi, and I can't remember it completely, but it seemed like a lot of times you guys carried three catchers, and you kind of had, I guess, a guy that you were comfortable with. John had one. Was that normal back in those days to have maybe more than two?
No. I mean, I think for the most part, we had two. We would always carry three in the postseason. And I, Bobby had two things in the postseason. He always carried an extra catcher, so a third catcher. And he always had a backup that was a true shortstop. Because to him, those were the two positions that if you get hurt, you better have somebody that can play. And you know, the whole third catcher thing was, you know, if, you know, God forbid one of your catchers gets in a car accident on the way to the ballpark and you only got one, you know, you've got one catcher the rest of the series. You know, that was the kind of stuff he thought about. So we always had that extra guy. But, you know, for the most part during the course of the year, it was, you know, we all threw to whoever the number one guy was, and then Greg would always throw to whoever the backup was. And you know, was some of it maybe his uncomfortableness with Javi, maybe. But I think more of it was, you know, the backup catcher is going to play at some point in time. So rather than everybody in the rotation having to deal with throwing to the backup guy and maybe not having that comfort level, Greg would do it. That was his guy. So it was a built-in off day every fifth day for the number one guy, whether it was Javi or Greg Olson or whoever it was over the years. So that was kind of the philosophy there. And, you know, I think for the most part, we were really fortunate all those years that our backup catchers were so good. I mean, they were tremendous game callers. They were tremendous defensive catchers. So if any one of us on a given night was thrown to one of those backup guys, it was not a big adjustment. But I do think it was probably a better situation for continuity, knowing that, you know, we were all going to throw to Javi, and Javi was going to get his day off when Greg pitched. And it.
So take me back. What was some of your early conversations like with Bobby Cox before you really got to know him and see the Hall of Fame manager that everybody else got to see?
Well, I think, you know, one of my first conversations that I remember with Bobby was when he called me one winter and told me he was not trading me. I think in the winter of, I want to say, 89, maybe.
He was the GM at the time.
And there was a lot of conversation going on that winter that I was going to be traded for either Wade Boggs or Mike Greenberg from the Red Sox. And you know, there was all kinds of speculation going on and on and on. And he finally, he picked up the phone. He called me one day and he said, listen, I know there's a lot of stuff out there, but I'm not trading you. So I just want to let you know that you're not getting traded. You're coming to spring training. And it was like, okay, great. So that was my first dealings with him. And he was very fair as a general manager. I mean, you know, he was not necessarily a guy that was going to, you know, claw your throat out, so to speak, to save, $20,000 on a contract. He was pretty fair about the whole process. And then, you know, when he ultimately took over in 1990, you know, you sensed the difference in the way things were going to be done. Not in a huge way, but I guess it was just the respect for all things baseball. You know, Bobby didn't have a whole lot of rules. It was basically You showed up on time, you wore your uniform the right way, and then you played hard. When the game started, you played hard, which really was not a lot to ask for. You know, he was very, very much a guy that was hands-off, so to speak, in the locker room. If there was an issue that he had to deal with, he would deal with it. But for the most part, he wanted us players to police things that were going on. And if somebody got out of line, then we dealt with it. And if he had to, he would, but he wanted us to deal with it. But, you know, you really got a sense early on with Bobby in the dugout that it was all about doing things the right way, playing the game the right way. And if you do all that, then eventually things are going to go your way and the results are going to get better. And they did. You know, when he took over in 1990, we were not a very good team the first half of the year. The second half of the year, we were a pretty good team. Our pitching staff had kind of come into play. You know, you had me and Smoltzy and Avery. You know, so the core of the guys were there. Justice was there. Gant was there. Blauser, Lemke. So everything was kind of there. In the second half of the year, we were a pretty good team. So you saw signs. Now, again, nobody in their right mind thought we were going to turn things around and win in 1991, but we knew we were headed in the right direction. But I think a lot of that change in attitude was a direct result of Bobby and how he went about his business and expected us to go about our business.
As you mentioned, when he takes over in 90, we know that the other part of the architect of building this team of the 90s was John Schuerholz, who's of course still with the organization. And in your mind, does he get the proper credit that he deserves, even though a lot of people look at the players on the field and Bobby in the dugout, but do you think Schuerholz gets his due?
I think he does, you know, because I think you can't look at the makeup of that team, the construction of that team, and not really be in a position to not have everybody be interchangeable and be a part of it. You know, I think one of the great things that when John came over and took over as the general manager, it was apparent right away that, you know, John was going to do his job. And he was going to let Bobby and the coaches do their job. There wasn't going to be this John trying to tell the coaches how to do their thing or any of that stuff, which, you know, for a while there's, you know, I love Ted Turner, but certainly things got a little bit crazy there in the late 80s when, you know, Ted was involved and ended up being a manager for a day and, you know, all that stuff that went on. I think it was very apparent that, you know, John was hired to do John's thing and the coaches were going to do their thing and everybody was going to be left to do their job and trusted to do their job. And, you know, I think that sometimes you look at some of the acquisitions and maybe don't realize how big they were, you know, even in that 1991 season, you know, it wasn't like John brought in guys that were blockbuster guys. but he brought in guys that knew how to win, that came from winning organizations, but most importantly were guys that knew how to play defense, which for a young pitching staff, we needed that. You know, we needed guys behind us that were going to catch the ball. I can't tell you how much that did for me confidence-wise, knowing that if I make a pitch and the ball's put in play, guys got behind me are going to make those plays. And it was guys like Terry Pendleton, Rafi Belliard, Sid Bream, you know, makes a trade for Otis Nixon late in spring training to play center field for us. So I think some of that maybe might go a little bit unnoticed or maybe not get enough notoriety for the subtle little moves that he made that year that really, really propelled us to be in a championship team that year. But, you know, and then subsequent years, you know, you can't help but notice what a good job he did. Because I think there are times where, you know, people look at our teams and they look at the run that we had and they think, well, I mean, how hard was it for Bobby? I mean, they had the same team every year and blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, maybe to some extent we had me and we had Smoltz and we had Maddox every year. But we had turnover every year, you know. Yeah. And Bobby was not afraid, to his credit, Bobby was not afraid to throw rookies into that lineup. I mean, you look at that team that won the World Series in 95, we had three rookies playing every day. And Bobby was not afraid to do that, you know. So every year it seemed we had turnover in our roster. And every year it seemed somebody came in as a rookie that was playing a prominent role. And like I said, Bobby wasn't afraid to do that. John wasn't afraid to do that. If they could play, they could play. And, you know, John was also really good at addressing the needs that we had as the season went on to get better. Another very unheralded move that was huge for us in 91, Alejandro Pena, we got after the trading deadline. Huge, huge piece of our bullpen. You know, obviously I think arguably the best trade he made was for Freddie McGriff. But certainly there were other moves along the way. BJ Surhoff was a huge pickup for us there in the mid 90s. So, I mean, there were a lot of things year to year that, that John did that were, you know, very, very, you know, in some cases, maybe a big splash. Obviously, signing Maddox was a big splash. But I think a lot of times it was just kind of the quiet, subtle little move that maybe was not the big name player, but certainly all of us in the clubhouse knew was the guy that made us a better team.
We have a question from Matthew. He wants to know, how gratifying is it for you that you and your teammates that defined a franchise, you're not just baseball players, but also part of the history of a lot of Braves fan families?
I mean, that's huge. Look, I mean, I can't tell you how gratifying it is, and it happens a lot, where I'll be out somewhere in a grocery store or whatever, and somebody will come over and shake my hand and say, hey, I just want to thank you. And it's like, okay, for what? You know, I've been a lifelong Braves fan. I just want to thank you for what you did for the organization, what you did for the city. That run you guys had was just unbelievable and so much fun to be a part of. And there's a generation of those people. I mean, when you look back and look at that run that we had, and it still blows my mind when I think about it, there are a generation of kids, you know, and I'll say in the Atlanta area, but we were really, I guess, baseball's version of the Dallas Cowboys for a long time. We were America's mm-hmm. team because of TBS. There are a generation of kids in Atlanta who from the time they started kindergarten through graduation in high school, we were in the playoffs every year.
Yeah.
And that's crazy to think about that, you know? And so when you think about that, you then have to think about the wide swath of people during that time in different stages of their lives being Braves fans and what that meant to them at the various stages of their lives and how they can relate to that. You know, it's a pretty awesome feeling to know that and know that you had that effect on people's lives and really were that much a part of people's lives on a yearly basis, knowing how much the Braves meant to them, how much it meant to them as a family to watch. I can't tell you how many people, it happened to me again today, where people will tell me, my grandmother is such a Braves fan and she loves you. And you know, you hear so many of those stories of grandparents that, you know, were sitting there with their grandchildren just hanging on every pitch. It's pretty cool to know you were a part of something like that and had such an impact on so many people's lives.
Yeah, and I mean, it. Like here, we have minor league, we have AAA, the Nashville Sounds, and that was my first baseball game, but there's no major league team in Nashville. The closest one is Atlanta and the Braves, and you know you have a hodgepodge here. There's some Reds fans, Cardinals, Cubs, but a huge chunk of Braves fans. And you know, like I was telling you earlier, I was young. I don't remember every little detail, especially 95 and, you know, before that. But that's a part of my childhood is watching you guys, you know, play in that run. And, you know, I was watching the 99 NLCS last night, you know, and I remember that one. I remember that vividly. I unfortunately remember what happened after in the World Series, but you know, it's crazy to think about what you just said, that there are kids in Atlanta that started in kindergarten and then graduated high school within that run. That's just, and you don't see that in sports. You don't see those kind of dynasties or those kind of runs anymore. And I just think it's cool. It's very cool.
No, yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, like I said, I think that's part of what makes us appreciate it so much. And you know how blessed you were to be a part of it, because not, you know, not only were there so many teams that were so good, but at the same time, on a personal level for me and Greg and John, to be able to play together for as long as we were able to play together, have the success that we had on the field as a team, to have the fun that we had off the field, playing golf and doing everything we did. There's no way in today's game, the economics of today's game, you would be able to keep three guys like that together for 10 years. No chance. So, yeah. You know, knowing that we're able to do that, you know, just again, it's another one of those things that, you know, how blessed you were that was able to happen, and you know, just how much fun it was that you were able to do that.
We've all been watching The Last Dance, and one of the things that has kind of come to my mind is I see some similarities between those Bulls teams and a lot of the core players that were there for the run, and you had some others come in and out. And I see the similarities between them and between you guys. Is that something that has kind of come to your mind as you watch it?
You know, I think the similarity that I see is at the end of the day is the expectation, right? And in baseball, you're not going to get one guy who can dominate the sport the way Michael dominated basketball. You're not going to get one guy that is going to be like that, I guess, and I may not say this properly, but you know, you're not going to have one guy on a baseball team that if, you know, he's there, you're phenomenal. If he's not, you're not.
Right.
To me in basketball, that's probably the one sport, maybe, you know, you'd argue a quarterback in football, but that's the one where if you've got that one really dominant guy, he can impact the game in that sport probably more than any other. I think in watching this, it's apparent in The Last Dance of the expectation that Michael had of his teammates. He wanted to win, and he expected to win. And he knew in order to win, everybody had to be on the same page with him, and that meant that he was going to piss some people off. And he was going to push some guys, but as he said, and I'm paraphrasing, he was, you know, going to drag guys along if he had to. But at the end of the day, it was all about the expectation. The expectation was to win. I think the similarity there is it was the same way in Atlanta. You know, the expectation to win. And I look at some of those younger guys who would come up from time to time, whether it was a Chipper or a Ryan Klesko or a Javi or, you know, Rafael Furcal, or, you know, you look at some of the pitchers, Kevin Millwood, Jason Marquis. It was tough for those guys coming up during that time because we had to win. We were expected to win, which meant, guess what, boys, buckle up. You got a job to do, and you better do it because we expect to win. You know, when I came up to the big leagues, the Braves were terrible. So it wasn't necessarily about winning. It was about developing. And I look at the situation that I had as a young player trying to break into the big leagues. That was much different than, hey, welcome to the big leagues. Now we win every year. You better carry your load. That's a far different set of expectations. So I think that's where the similarity is. The similarity is that both teams had a very high expectation of winning, which meant that everybody on that roster better be on board and better be prepared to do what they needed to do in order to get to that ultimate goal, which was to win. I just think in the case with The Last Dance, Michael was obviously that one guy that drove that bus and made everybody get on it, whereas in baseball, I think it's a little bit more collective.
Was there a guy with you all that had that type of drive similar to Michael and just expecting the best out of everyone and would push, as you were just saying? Was there that one guy within your clubhouse, or was it a few?
I think it was a collection. You know, I think that ultimately, you know, when you get to that stage that we were at, you know, there are a lot of guys that way. I mean, I know I was that way. I know Greg was that way. Smolty was that way. Chipper was that way. You know, I think in our sport, on a little bit more of an individual basis, you know, the great players have a different drive, right? They're not content with just being good. They're content with finding out how good they can be. And I think there's a difference. You know, there are a lot of guys that are content with just being good, and people are saying nice things about them, and, hey, you're a good player, and the whole nine yards. Any great player that I've been around, they're not satisfied with just being good or being viewed as good by outside people. There's a desire inside of them to see how good they can be. And if they do something good, they want to do it better, or they want to see how good they can do it. You know, I know that was always the case for me personally. You know, I had a lot of good years in baseball. I never had a perfect year. There was always something that I didn't do well that I thought I could do better the next year. Or there was something that I thought, hey, maybe I can do this next year. Maybe I could add this pitch, or maybe I could change this a little bit. So there was always that drive in my mind to see how good I could be. And I think great players have that. There's, like I said, there's a desire to push yourself, to see how far you can push yourself, and to see what limit of success or greatness, whatever word you want to use, that you can get to. And I think, like I said, I personally feel that you show me a great player and I'll show you a guy that was really driven, really determined, and really pushed himself to see how good he could be, and wasn't satisfied with how good other people told him he was.
Tom Glavin, Hall of Famer, here with us on game night. Did you, when you heard that Michael Jordan was leaving basketball and he was going to go play baseball and try and make it to the major leagues, what kind of went through your mind? What was the conversation like with some of your teammates?
You know, I think there was a lot of speculation. There were a lot of questions. You know, why is he doing this? What's going on? You know, I think there were a lot of guys that were in the camp of which they talked about in the show that, you know, maybe this was some kind of a hidden suspension because there were some other things going on with gambling or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, having watched the show now and seen Michael's explanation and David Stern and all that, then, yeah, I mean, I'm you know, there's no doubt in my mind that wasn't the case. And you know, I can see now watching the show and seeing, you know, where Michael was at. You know, there is a burnout factor. I think it happens to every athlete. You know, does it happen to every athlete to the extent that happened to Michael, where he walked away and went and played another sport? No. But I think every athlete in their sport, if they play the game long enough and play it at a high enough level to where the expectations are high, the demands are high, there is a burnout factor, no question about it. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that for me, and I would venture to say for John and for Greg, they would probably tell you the same thing. That's where us doing the things that we did away from the baseball field, particularly playing golf, mm-hmm. That's where that was so helpful. Because, you know, it's a grind. It's a grind playing any sport at the professional level because it's a long season. Your body is beat up. You're mentally and emotionally exhausted. And if you don't have an outlet to get away from that, then that stuff just gets compounded and it gets worse. And I would venture to say that most people, not playing a professional sport but in a professional life, would tell you the same thing. There's a burnout factor. If you're going to work every day, 9 to 5, and doing something every single day and pressures and all that stuff start mounting on you, yeah, there's a burnout. If you don't have a release, you're going to have problems. And I think that was apparent with Michael. I don't know that any athlete in any sport has had the demands put on them that Michael had put on him. I can only speak to what we went through at a much smaller level than what Michael certainly experienced. But there was no question in my mind that that camaraderie, that friendship that Greg and John and I had, and that ability to get away from baseball and play golf and do all that stuff and take our mind off of the rigors of a baseball season for a little while, you know, three or four times a week, whatever the case may have been. I think that was immensely helpful in all of us in terms of keeping us mentally and physically fresh.
How often do you get to see Greg and John? I know obviously John's in broadcasting too, so that helps, but how often do the three of you actually get together?
It's gotten better. You know, it's at least three times a year now. So, you know, we play in a golf tournament in January. We play in a golf tournament in Orlando in January. We play in Tahoe in July, and then we have Hall of Fame weekend. So there's at least those three periods during the course of the year that we know we're going to get together. And then anything else beyond that is you know, kind of icing on the cake. You know, I'm a little bit sad. Truth be told, a lot of bit sad, but obviously we're living in the world that we're living in. We were scheduled to go to Scotland the first week in June to play some golf. So that's which is kind of a bummer, but you know, certainly we have an opportunity to do it again somewhere down the road. But you know, it's been good because you know, you can count on those three times every year. Hopefully there's more. But you know, it's fun. I mean, I get around those guys and I don't care if I haven't talked to them in 2 months. When we get around each other, it's like we just saw each other yesterday, and you know, there's a lot of smack talking and storytelling, and you know, it's just generally a pretty fun time.
Happy birthday to Smoltzy.
Yeah, that's
today
right.
Is his birthday.
Yeah, so yeah, MLB Network showing him a lot of love today. So
yeah, a very cool thing. We were talking to the 1984 fifth round pick of the LA Kings, Tom Glavine, here with us, and
fourth round pick.
Yes. So you brought that up earlier that you're a Bruins fan, but people may not realize you played hockey and you were an NHL draft pick. What obviously it worked out. It worked out for you going baseball, but did you ever consider, especially like in 94 with the strike, you know, and that was something that was brought up in The Last Dance, that was one reason why he went back. Did you ever think about jumping back into hockey at that point, or was there ever a time that you thought about playing?
I had one brief moment that not so much that I thought about it, but I knew it was a fallback. My very first summer, I signed professionally after my high school season in 1984, went to rookie ball, and about 3 weeks to a month in, my arm started hurting, and I thought, oh, my God, if I've blown out my arm, well, at least I can go back to college and play hockey. And I got over it, and then that was it. I never looked back. Now, there were plenty of times where, you know, if I went home to Boston to see my parents and I went to a Bruins game and I was there, yes, I 100% wondered what would have happened. I missed playing the whole nine yards. But, you know, as time went on, obviously that missing the game went away. I don't know to this day if the wondering what would have happened will ever completely go away. Of course I would wonder. I mean, I think we all can look at our lives and see, you know, some sort of crossroad, so to speak, or some sort of important decision that we made that we wonder, man, if I had made that decision differently, how would things have turned out, right? Yeah. And I'm no different. I mean, I look at it and I think, okay, I really have a really hard time believing that my hockey career would have gone any better than baseball went. But at the same time, I wonder what would have happened, you know, and you know, my joke is always, and I say this completely facetiously, you know, that clearly I would have been a Hall of Famer in hockey because I was drafted ahead of Luke Robitaille and Brett Hull, both of who are in the Hall of Fame. So clearly a Hall of Famer in hockey. I say that facetiously. I know it would have been a tough go. I was 6 feet tall. I was 175 pounds coming out of high school, and that was a dime a dozen in hockey. So I had nothing in hockey that set me apart, so to speak. Being a left-handed pitcher kind of set me apart a little bit in baseball. So that was the big reason why I chose baseball. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I still love hockey. I still play it a little bit here and there, and I still – like I said, I wonder what would have happened, but I have zero regret about the decision I made because I know it was the right one.
Obviously, we love hockey here in Nashville with the Predators. And you mentioned that Vancouver Canucks team and that you still hate them. So do we. So the feeling is mutual for sure. It's funny to hear you talk about playing hockey and playing baseball and making the decision. One thing that one of my co-hosts, Willie Donick, who was a two-sport athlete, he played baseball at Vanderbilt, played basketball at Vanderbilt, that he always says of how important it is growing up to play multiple sports, not just to focus on the one.
Right.
And I think I heard you mention that your kids played hockey and baseball or play multiple sports. How important is that when you're developing?
I think it's immensely important. I mean, I think if there's one thing that I don't like about youth sports today, it's the push to have kids specialize or play one sport at such an early age. I don't know. It may be changing a little bit now in baseball. I don't know about other sports. I can only speak to baseball. Maybe changing a little bit now because I think you're seeing more and more guys in the big leagues now that have grown up in this era where you better specialize in a sport. But you take guys my age that played baseball or maybe go back even 15 years, and I don't think you'll find any guy that will tell you any different than, hey, your kids need to play multiple sports. We all did it. We all played more sports. If we weren't playing our primary, you know, you take guys in the big leagues now, or when I played, whatever their primary position was in the big leagues, when they're playing high school ball or college ball, they were probably playing another primary position. Now you see in the big leagues this era of pitcher only, you know, so these guys that are in the big leagues as pitchers, they never played another position. They never swung a bat. They never did any of that. And I hate that, you know. I mean, to me, I remember we had Mark Grant, who was a relief pitcher for us. He was about the only guy that was on any of our rotations that as a pitcher didn't play shortstop or center field and hit third or fourth in his high school lineup. Everybody else did, and that was the way that it was. And now in today's world, there's such a push to get these kids to specialize in one sport at such an early age, and I hate it, you know. And I think it's partly driven by parents. It's partly driven by youth coaches. You know, these youth coaches are all pushing these kids that, you know, hey, you better specialize and you better pick a sport because if you don't, Johnny down the street is, and he's going to pass you by and he's going to be better than you. And that's kind of their spiel. But all the while, it's more about trying to keep the best team together so they can win. And this coach looks good. You have parents now, you know, if I've heard it once, I heard it a million times. Well, you know, I want my kid to play at the next level. Well, what does that mean? What do you mean you want your kid to play at the next level? I know what it means when they're saying it. They think their kid's going to get a Division I scholarship or their kid's going to play professionally. Well, the likelihood of that happening is so remote that it's hard for people to get their brains around. For the most part, the next level for most of these kids is high school. So rather than focusing on the next level, which we all know what that means, focus on supporting your children and focus on your kids having fun. You know, when I played, and again, I know it's different because we didn't have social media, we didn't have all that stuff. I never really ever thought seriously about playing any of those sports professionally until I was a senior in high school. You know, up until that point in time, I just played because it was fun. And I played because I had a lot of good friends and it was what I wanted to do. You know, now, that's not to say as a kid I didn't have a dream of being Bobby Orr or Collier Skrumsky or one of those guys. But that's not why I played. I played because I had fun. And it just so happened that as time went on, I realized, oh, my God, I might have a chance to do this at college or professionally. And then that happened. Today, like I said, I think that notion of playing college ball or getting a college scholarship, you know, and being able to go on Twitter and say, hey, I committed here, or hey, I'm going to play professionally, is so much more a part of the equation that it's taken the fun out of it for the kids. And I think that's so unfair. And I still believe that kids should be exposed to as many sports as they can, figure out what they like, what they don't like. Somewhere down the road, maybe in high school, let them specialize on a sport if they have to. But until that time, it should be about having fun and enjoying it and making great lasting friendships in the whole nine yards. It's like, you know, I always tell people, you know, when it comes to your kid playing professionals or playing sports, it should be a situation to where your son, your daughter plays this sport. And the day that sport ends, you know, fortunately for me, I was 40 plus years old and I was in the big leagues. But for a lot of kids, for a lot of people, it's high school. When the day comes, you want them to look back and go, you know what? That was a ton of fun. I had a blast. I made some great friends. When I'm a parent, I want to provide that same opportunity for my kids. Not look back at it and go, oh my God, I was going here and there and I was traveling everywhere and I got pushed and I got, that was a miserable experience. That to me is, it would be a shame. So, I mean, that's kind of the way I approached it with my kids. I wanted them to be exposed to as much as they could and play as much as they could. Now, you can't do everything, obviously, but, you know, to me, at least multiple sports. And then once you get to high school, yeah, you know, maybe at that point in time, figure out what you want to do, unless you're fortunate enough to be really good at two sports or three sports. And if that's the case, keep playing.
Very well said. Very well said. Tom Glavin, Hall of Famer, here with us. And I do want to get your thoughts real quick on everything going on. Obviously, an unprecedented time and something you can't really prepare for. A lot of decisions have to be made. And we know this week that baseball and the Players Association, they're having meetings. And you know, there are finances involved. And you have some players like Blake Snell that are very outspoken about not playing. And one thing that Tim Kirchen brought up when he was on with us was he referenced 94 and your role in 94 and that they had back then players like Tom Glavin that were able to guide those waters. And even if, you know, labor disputes happened again or got close to that, there were players like yourself that had gone through it. And now you don't necessarily have that, even though this is a different situation. So how do you view what's going on right now? And what's some advice that you might have?
You know, I think that without knowing or being in privy to conversations, right, I'll just speak in general terms. I think players have every right to be concerned about their health, no question about it. And I think it's the kind of thing that, like I've said to people, you know, if for me today, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia has opened up businesses. On a limited scale, I can choose to go to a restaurant. I can choose to go to a grocery store. I can choose to expose myself however I want. You get into a situation where you're back playing baseball and people are telling you you're going to travel and you have to get on a plane and you have to do all that stuff. You've lost control. And that's not an easy thing to give up, especially when a lot of these guys have wives and kids at home. Because the last thing you want to do is get it and bring it home, right? So that's where you're perfectly 100% right to ask questions. You should ask questions. You have to, I guess, put some trust in the people that are smarter than all of us to figure out what the best course of action is and how can we do this as safely as possible. There's nothing that anybody can do to tell you 100% if we do this, nobody's going to get sick. But if we can get it to a point where it's really, really close, then I think you got to think about it. Now, you get guys who say, hey, I'm not playing. Okay. That's your right to say that. Are you really prepared to go through with that? Are you saying I'm not going to play, but you expect to get paid? Or are you saying I'm not going to play knowing you're not going to get paid? I'm not saying that's going to happen one way or the other, but I can promise you it's a part of conversations, right? So when I can equate it to the 94-95 situation in the sense that I would tell players, if you're going to speak, be informed about what you're speaking about and be careful about what you're saying. Because I can promise you, and I know this is a little bit different, but I can promise you, there were a number of times during that 94-95 situation where a player would go on TV and give an interview and say something that was not true that was going on, that was his opinion or his understanding, knowing he hadn't been in any meetings, he didn't understand everything that was going on, and the owners would look at that and go, okay, if we just wait a little bit longer, we got these guys. So you got to be careful about what you're saying, because you don't know what you say is going to prolong the situation by even a day. You know, could be a day, could be 2 weeks, who knows? So just be careful and make sure you have your facts straight and make sure you really understand what you're saying. Now, I will say this from a fan standpoint, from a former player standpoint. Again, players have every right to ask all these questions about health, 100%. When it comes to the economics of it, I think you got to have an open mind. You know, I'm not sure that as a player I would expect to make a full salary given we're only going to have a half a year. I mean, this is a unique situation. And as much as put my players union hat on and say, you know, the heck with the owners and dig your heels in, the 94 situation was much different than this situation. This is a situation none of us have ever experienced, none of us would have ever seen, and we're all trying to navigate it. Now, having said that, I understand the Players Association's concerns about agreeing to a 50-50 revenue split, because at the end of the day, that was the essence of the strike in 94 and 95. That's a salary cap. Right. Now, whether you want to call it that or not, fine. Whether you want to say, hey, these are extenuating circumstances, therefore we need to think differently, fine. All I'm saying is we've seen it. We've seen it in our own lives. We see it in politics every day. Once you agree to something and you give something up, so to speak, it's really hard to take it back. So I can understand the Players Association's concerns in saying, well, if we agree to this 50-50 split in revenue, does that open the door for more discussions about a salary cap? I 100% agree with that. I get it. I'm not saying that's the case. And again, I'm not privy to the conversations, but I think there has to be some give and take on both sides. And, you know, I don't know how to navigate through it. Again, I'm not sure that if I was a player today and we weren't going to play a full season, maybe a half a season, that I could sit here and honestly make an argument to you that, well, that's too bad, owners. You still need to pay me my full salary. I don't know that I could make that argument. But in fairness, I think that it certainly is a starting point. I think there's no question that both sides are going to have to sit down and figure out a way to navigate through the economics of the game. But I can tell you this, having been through it in 1994 and 1995, in this environment, people want to get back to normal. And normal is watching sports. And much like I equated it to a little bit in a previous interview to when we came back from 9/11. We were the first team to go into New York and play. And the emotion that was in Shea Stadium when we went back that first game was unbelievable. And knowing that these people in New York were getting a break from what they were dealing with for a couple of hours, and in the long term, being able to say, hey, we're getting back to normal now because, you know, baseball's back. That's all part of it. So people want their normalcy back. And part of their normalcy is watching their sports, which includes baseball, obviously, this time of year. At the end of the day, in 94, 95, we took a beating as players. You know, the baseball took a beating from fans who swore they were never going to come back. And I think a fairly good percentage of them never did. Yeah. If you allow that situation to happen again here, to where all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted, but we couldn't come to an economic agreement, baseball is going to take a beating. And I just think it's something that neither side should allow to happen. If there's any lessons to be learned from the 94-95 strike, it's that. Because I know, again, having been a part of it, when we went through it again, I don't know what it was, 5 or 6 years later on the heels of 9/11, that was the cloud that was hanging over us, all of us, during those negotiations, was we can't do this again. We can't do this to baseball. We can't do this to baseball coming off the heels of 9/11. We can't do this to the country. And it had a big impact on those negotiations. And I think this situation will have a big impact on what ultimately is decided as well. But like I said, I can understand the trepidation on the player side.
Very, very well said. Tom Glavine, the Hall of Famer, a Braves legend, Mets too. But hey, we appreciate the time today. You've been very generous with your time, and I know it's a Friday night. This has been fun. I have a list of questions I didn't even get to, but I've really enjoyed this. This has been awesome.
It's been fun. I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate your thinking outside the box and making things fun for people every day. So good for you.
Absolutely. And go Braves. It should be a fun season whenever that season gets started. But I really like the build and the makeup of this team right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. So hopefully we're going to see it sooner than later.
All right. He is the Hall of Famer, Tom Glavine. That's going to do it for game night here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.